Here's Andy Udman.
Let's talk about you. You take prescription drugs, but you lead an active life, and you're tired of all those unexpected side effects. It's time to talk to your doctor about a new drug called Side Effects. With Side Effects, you'll experience no unexpected side effects because you expect them all.
We have a cornucopia of drugs available to us today, and unfortunately, these drugs are not making us any healthier, and that was their promise.
Side Effects is the only drug on the market that provides no medical benefit whatsoever. It's just a drug that does terrible, irreversible things to your mind and body. Side Effects covers its bases, from run-of-the-mill effects like dizziness and headache, to more exotic ones like a furry spider that grows inside your brain. Oh, and nausea. Did we mention nausea?
Their promise was that these drugs were supposed to make us healthier as a society, and unfortunately, this promise hasn't come true. And if anything is true, the cornucopia of drugs that we have out there on the marketplace today are actually making us much, much sicker.
Side effects include drooling, priapsy, dry mouth, constipation, stomach upset, and alcoholism. Ask your doctor if Damitol is right for you.
I used to feel like myself. Now I feel like somebody else. I like it better.
Damitol. Well, those are some great spoof clips of a drug called Damitol and Side Effects.
Mm-hmm. We see so many parodies out there. Saturday Night Live has been doing parodies on Big Pharma, Bill Maher, so many comedians, Jon Stewart. They're just spoofing the pharmaceutical drugs left, right, and center out there.
So it's not just me who's amused at these drug commercials on I see every night on ABC News. 30 seconds of how it'll improve your life, a minute and a half on how your eyes will explode, you'll have permanent diarrhea, and you may die.
Mm-hmm. And now they want to distill down those side effects in the ads. So
unbelievable. Folks, we have so much to talk about in this hour. I don't know how we're going to cram it all in. In fact, we're not going to be able to. One particular issue we want to talk about later in the hour is sleep deprivation, especially with the time change coming up this weekend. So we're going to talk about this claim this morning on Steve Garrison's show that heart attacks actually shoot up by something like 20% and car crashes spike. And late in the hour, I'll be asking Pam for her theory on that. I want to talk about health because we have a crisis in our health system. And it is just about as dramatic as what is happening in the Ukraine. It seems every Thursday when we invite Pam Colleen to come in and rock the boat, she rocks it more than most of us can handle, because I get so many calls and emails afterwards saying, where do I get help? Where do I get help? And this morning, Pam, we're going to talk about prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And you have an amazing guest this morning.
Right. We're very fortunate this morning to have Dr. John Abramson on the phone with us. He's the author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. And he is a Harvard lecturer and a medical doctor. And he's here to share with us his concerns about the overprescribing of drugs here in North America.
Dr. Abramson, welcome to the show. Welcome to Canada.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the show, and it's a pleasure to be heard in Canada.
I have a question for you. Have you ever had a Tim Hortons coffee?
I have not.
In Canada, the most noticeable landmark across the country now is Tim Hortons. It's a coffee shop which got ridiculously popular, and there's one on every corner. Across the street from virtually every Tim Hortons, there's a Shoppers Drug Mart. Why is that, Dr. Abramson?
It's because the pharmaceutical industry is incredibly good at what they do, Andy. And what we need to remember before we get into the details of our conversation, what we need to remember is that the drug industry's job is to sell as many drugs as they can and make as much profit as they can to return that to their shareholders and their executives as well. That's their job, and they do it well. When they have phrases like this drug company is designed to serve the people and we're here to meet the medical needs of the public and we're dedicated to public health, those are created by public relations companies to make the drug companies appear, to convince the public that the drug companies have a job other than to maximize their profits. But their job is to maximize their profits, and they do it enormously well.
What is the most popular drugstore in America?
Is that Walgreens?
Walgreens.
It could be Walgreens or CVS. I'm not sure.
Okay. Make a comparison. We have a Shoppers Drug Mart and various other drugstores on virtually every other corner in big cities. Same story in America.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And they're opening up every few minutes, aren't they? I mean, I heard some statistics about these drugstores opening up within minutes of each other.
Yes, absolutely. But the key is to get right into the heart of the matter. The drug companies deciding whether to take a drug or not, and your doctor deciding whether to prescribe a drug or not, would be like going to a gambling casino, to a poker table, and playing poker against the house, except the rules of the game are that the house never has to lay its cards down. It can just say what it has in its hand and claim the pot. So the drug companies are funding virtually all of the studies about brand name drugs, and they don't have to turn those results over to the editors of the medical journals, to the peer reviewers of the medical journals. Often the authors, the articles don't get free access to the data. The doctors certainly don't get free access to the data. It's just what the drug companies claim the data say. They keep the data proprietary, like the recipe for Coke. And we only find out what the truth is in litigation 5 or 10 years later. It's a crazy system where the generation of public knowledge, of medical knowledge, has been privatized over the last 30 or 40 years, and there's virtually no oversight of the integrity of that information.
But the doctors are on the front line. You were and are a frontline doctor. And many, many years ago, you started questioning the system, which resulted in your book, Overdosed America. Are other doctors getting more savvy to these issues?
You know, it's an interesting question, Pam. Doctors are getting slightly more savvy to these issues. But as they get more savvy, it makes them more vulnerable. I got an email from an 84-year-old doctor a couple of weeks ago. He said, I'm 10 years behind the time. I just read your book, Overdosed America. And I was discussing it. This is an 84-year-old retired doctor. And I was discussing it with my younger colleagues in the doctor's lounge and trying to tell them how much they're being misled by the misrepresentations of the clinical trials and the medical science. And the younger doctors said, no. That used to happen, but it doesn't happen anymore, because they don't allow the drug companies to give us free meals or take us to sporting events anymore. So that was in the past. And what this doctor, and he asked me to write him and tell him whether it's true or not, or whether he's on a false crusade. And what this doctor's email showed is how skillful the drug companies are at maintaining the belief in the practicing doctors that they're really telling the truth. And until the practicing doctors understand that it's impossible for them to fulfill their responsibilities as learned intermediaries if they can't get access to the real data, until they understand that and they're willing to take a stand on that collectively, then the public is going to continue not to just to get cheated out of money, but to get cheated out of their health.
And doctors, I spoke to a doctor recently who denied the fact that there's a relationship between the statin drugs and the muscle stiffness that can happen in people who are taking these drugs. She outright denied it was a side effect, yet it's a very common side effect with the statin drugs. She's totally oblivious to this fact.
Doctor, let me ask you this question as we wedge our way and drill deeper into this issue. We just had an anesthesiologist in Canada, Dr. Dudenot, sent to prison because he was sexually assaulting the patients in surgery. It's an absolutely shocking story, and it's hard to believe that any doctor could be that evil. I like to think that doctors are some of our finest citizens, that they're among the brightest, that they are very committed, that they are hardworking, and I know some absolutely wonderful doctors. So I'm asking you, if the drug companies are able to foist this kind of evil upon us, are our doctors generally that stupid, crooked, overworked, underinformed? How do you explain our doctors allowing all this to happen?
Right, that's the key question. And the short answer is, Andy, that the doctors are victims in this, just like the patients are, because the sources of information that doctors have been taught to trust in medical school and residency training, and the sources of information that are used to establish the standards of care, have been corrupted. And I think that 99% of doctors are hardworking. They're not on the take from the drug companies. They doing their best. They're overworked, but they're doing their best to serve their patients. I don't think the doctors are guilty of any sin except one, and that sin is naivete. Mm-hmm. That it's so hard for them to accept. It's such a bitter pill for doctors to accept, and I'm going to get back to Pam's question about the statin side effects, but it's such a bitter pill for doctors to acknowledge that the drug companies have systematically infiltrated the sources of information that they have been taught to trust and must trust to practice consistent with community standards. It's too hard for them. So they're not, it's a line they don't want to cross because they become outsiders. It becomes very hard to practice medicine when you acknowledge that the information you're getting is not, is often not accurate, and you can't tell the difference between what's accurate and what's not accurate. So to go back to Pam's question about the doctor who insisted there were no muscle or very rare muscle symptoms, side effects related to statins. That doctor has done her homework, and she has read the clinical trials. And the clinical trials say that there's very few muscle problems. Why? Because the people who are brought into those clinical trials are screened. They are often given a test dose, a run-in period of drug, and if they have side effects, they're taken out. Side effects are not monitored aggressively, so they're often missed. So if you read the literature from the drug company-sponsored clinical trials of statins, the incidence of muscle side effects is very rare. And yet if you just go out and ask people if they're having side effects, it's going to be 10 or 20%.
But aren't doctors today, some of them are saying that about half of their doctor visits are due to the side effects of prescription drugs, including the statins?
I don't know if it's that high, Pam, but yes.
Some doctors are saying
that.
Yes
is the answer. I mean, a study was done here in Boston on electronic medical records, and the records were scanned for, it was people on statins, and the records were scanned for the incidence of statin-related side effects. So these were not interviews where patients were specifically asked whether they were having a statin-related side effect. These are office notes where patients spontaneously offered that they were having statin-related side effects, and the incidence was 18%. Now, 18% of people taking statins have side effects. Now, if you look at the statin guidelines, the benefits of statins are nowhere near that. And I hope we can turn to the recent changes in the statin guidelines in the United States and the proposed changes in the UK, because people are going to be stunned at the minimal benefit that statins have for people at low risk of heart disease who are being brought into the population for whom statins are recommended.
Now, I want to bring people's attention to the op-ed piece you wrote for the New York Times. This was in November 2013, and the title essentially encapsulates your article very well. It says, "Don't give more patients statins." So what is the heart and soul of your article here?
The heart and soul of the article, Pam, is that the op-ed piece came out. We wrote it immediately after the statin guidelines were changed in the United States. And in the United States, the guidelines changed to include about another 30 million people for whom statins became recommended. And these are people at low risk of heart disease. They have less than 20% less than 20% chance of heart disease over the next 10 years. Statins became recommended for all of those people who have between 7.5% and 20% chance of heart disease over the next 10 years. An additional 30 million people became recommended for statins on that day. I think it was November 12th or 11th. The problem with this is that you would think that there was overwhelming evidence that giving statins to these people would improve their overall health, when the truth is that it doesn't decrease their risk of dying at all. It doesn't decrease their risk of having a serious illness at all. And in order to avoid one heart attack or stroke, you have to treat 120 people for 5 years, but that heart attack or stroke is going to get replaced by another serious illness, so you haven't decreased serious illness at all. So you're treating 30 million people for no net health benefit, and at least 18% of them are going to have side effects.
And so the cure is worse than the disease, essentially, is what you're saying.
Well, the disease is bad, and that's what the drug companies are playing on.
How do you...
Let me just answer Pam. Mm-hmm. The cure is not the cure, is what I'm saying. That if you want to prevent heart disease, the World Health Organization says 80% of heart disease is the result of unhealthy lifestyle. And turning to statins diverts, not just takes their money, but it diverts their attention from making the changes in their lifestyle that would actually improve their health.
That's right.
How do you explain Americans being so stupid to have this foisted on them?
Well, the Brits are just a few months behind. I think we have a rather unique situation in the United States. Canada spends about 55% as much as we do on health care, and you Canadians have better health statistics than we do in the United States. So my interpretation of this, and I'm just getting into another book now, and this is one of the themes that I want to get into in the book, is that bad medical information doesn't respect national boundaries. They're multinational corporations, and the bad information is spread multinationally. In the United States, because of the direct-to-consumer advertising that's allowed here, and because of the kind of free corporate speech environment we have here, is much more valuable in the United States than it is in other countries. So, for example, the arthritis drug Vioxx that killed between 40 and 60,000 Americans, like close to the number of Americans that died in the Vietnam War. 80% of the Vioxx, the arthritis drug Vioxx, that was prescribed in the world was prescribed in the United States. And the drug Neurontin that got prescribed so much off-label, an anti-seizure drug that got prescribed for pain and migraine headaches and bipolar disease and so forth without adequate scientific justification, 88% of Neurontin was prescribed in the United States. So I think what's happening in the United States is just an exaggerated example of what's happening in the rest of the world. And what it is market failure in medical knowledge. We've turned medical knowledge over to the marketplace, and it's failing, just the way the banks failed. But nobody understands it because the science is so complex, and it's hidden. You can't get to the science outside of litigation.
Now they want to pass. They want to pass a law here in Canada, Vanessa's law. Maybe we could talk.
We need to break. Doctor, do you know the name Rob Ford?
No.
He's the mayor of Toronto, who's been on Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh, sure, of course I know Rob Ford.
He had this strange thing with the other kind of drugs. When he took crack cocaine, he started speaking another language. He started speaking Jamaican. I want to ask you about the effects of some of these lovely drugs when we come back in just a moment with Dr. John Abramson. Hopefully he's still speaking English when we come back in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. To that in our next hour. We're talking about another crisis. Pam Colleen, along with our guest this morning, Dr. John Abramson, author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. Doctor, if I can just ask you a general lead question going into this. What is the state of health of the United States of America today?
The state of health in the United States is that we are losing ground to virtually all the other wealthy countries. So even though we're spending literally twice as much per person on health care every year, the comparative health of Americans to the other wealthy industrialized countries continues to lose ground. When I wrote Overdosed America, there's a measure that is probably the best single measure of the health of the population. It's called healthy life expectancy. It's the number of years that the average citizen will live in good health. And if they're sick and the sickness compromises the quality of their life by 50%, then they get a half of a year of healthy life expectancy for that. So that's a global measure of the health of the population. When I wrote Overdosed America, we ranked 22nd in the world, even though we were spending twice as much as the other countries. In the last 10 years, we've gone from ranking 22nd to ranking 26th. So in the United States, we're now wasting $1 trillion a year on health care for which there's no demonstrable benefit and a lot of evidence of harm, while the American citizens are actually losing ground in comparison to the other countries that are spending half as much.
Now, I want to ask you a question about accountability here. There's a federal MP here in Canada who is attempting to pass a law called Vanessa's Law. And what the law would entail would be that if pharmaceutical companies are caught doing deceitful marketing practices or what have you, that they could be fined up to $5 million a day. Do you see this being any kind of deterrent? Would it help the situation at all?
It would help a little, Pam, but in the United States, we've had fines. GlaxoSmithKline just got fined $3 billion for its marketing, illegal or allegedly illegal marketing of a number of drugs, including its diabetes drug Avandia. Pfizer got fined $2.3 billion for alleged illegal marketing. So the business model of the pharmaceutical companies right now is that they expect to get caught and fined, but that those fines won't come close to their ill-begotten profit.
That's right.
How
the model that's based just on economic penalties isn't going to work. When petty criminals go to a convenience store and rob a convenience store of $20, they'll go to jail. The drug companies can rob the government and the people of billions of dollars, and nobody goes to jail.
That's right.
So there's this asymmetry in crime and punishment, and that's the problem. Until the punishment is greater than the odds of the of benefiting from the ill-begotten gains, this game is going to continue. And people who understand this field know it's a game. It's a cat-and-mouse game. But it's not a game. People are getting hurt, and their health is suffering. And governments are wasting money. It's like siphoning off the public's tax money to pay for things that aren't helpful. It's not a game, and it needs to be treated seriously.
Dr. Abramson, I don't know if you have a political bone in your body, but if you were to run for office with the kind of agenda that you're talking about, would you get any votes?
Yeah, I would get some votes. I'd get some very committed votes, and then there would be an enormous campaign against me run by the best public relations companies in the country, explaining why my opinion wasn't valid. And people who are trying to be good citizens and understand what's going on would not be able to make heads or tails out of the confusion that resulted.
But we have two camps. We have the misinformation camp, and then we have the truth. I mean, people are getting tons of misinformation. They can't distinguish between misinformation and truth. What do we do about educating consumers? How do we get consumers on board in order to fight this mess?
Right. Well, look, that's a great question, Tam, and that's really where all this heads. So the first issue is to understand what's going on and how very serious it is. Serious for almost every listener will have a family member who's affected by this. And to understand that the drug companies are doing what they're supposed to do in a capitalist marketplace. They're maximizing their profit. They do that by manipulating the information that's available to physicians. Now, physicians and patients together need to rise up politically and demand that the data from clinical trials be made publicly available. Until that data is publicly available, doctors are playing pin the tail on the donkey, completely blindfolded, when they read the most respected medical journals, because that information has not been vetted. It's sitting in corporate vaults, and corporations are making claims about the information. So the first step is to understand how serious it is, and that the information needs to be made public. The second step, which people can do right away, is to understand that 70% of our health has to do with how we live our lives. And we, for the most part, have control over that, whether we exercise or not, whether we smoke or not, whether we drink too much or not, whether we eat a healthy diet. 70% of our health is determined by that. The drug company's job is to take our attention away from how empowered each of us is to make healthy decisions in our own life and help our families make healthy decisions, to expropriate that sense of responsibility for health and to give it to the doctors, ask your doctor, when the doctor's being fed misinformation.
You have a politician in the United States who was enormously popular, and they even talk about him for president until he ran into some turbulence recently, and that's the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. He's a large man. He has a huge weight problem, and he has suggested in the past that might, in fact, prevent him from running just because he didn't want to embarrass his family. Let me ask you about the I want to ask you about a number of health issues in the U.S. and to rank them, but let's start with obesity. How big, how bad?
Big and bad. Over a third of American adults are obese. Now, why? Because it has to do with the food industry. It has to do with high-pressured life. It has to do with watching television. I personally think that the thing that it has most to do with is the subsidies of corn and corn syrup, so that Americans now have about 500 calories worth of corn syrup in their diet that they didn't used to have. And you do the math, it's 3,500 calories per pound. It doesn't take long to gain an extra pound if you add 500 extra calories of corn syrup to your diet. And if you stay calorie neutral, then you're going to chase out good nutrition. So it's an enormous health problem and an economic problem. And I think it reflects the failure of the marketplace, for the most part, to serve the public interest the same way that the drug industry is showing that the marketplace can't work to set its own values and to oversee the integrity of its own knowledge. We need some government, and government needs to look out for the people. Now, that said, we've got a real problem in the United States, because Obamacare, which is labeled as socialist and a government takeover of healthcare and the beginning of the end of freedom in the United States, it's all ridiculous. It was negotiated behind the scenes by the drug companies and the hospital industry and the insurance industry and everyone else who has money to make, paying off the politicians. So what we've got in the United States is a democracy of capital, not a democracy of the people's interest.
Mm-hmm.
And we really got a problem, because it's complicated information. So the public can't get underneath the misinformation that they're getting. Neither can doctors.
What is your sense of where Canada's rates on that same score?
You're way better than we are. You have a much more vibrant discourse about these issues. It's not perfect, and there are threats to your healthcare system that are very real coming from the marketplace. But I'm on a listserv with many Canadians. It's a Canadian listserv. And I've lectured to primary care doctors in Canada, and it's a very different experience than lecturing to primary care doctors in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Your doctors are much more focused on taking care of your patients and trying to cut through, trying to understand the misinformation, whereas American doctors are much more defensive about the sources of information that they've been taught to trust. So you're way ahead of us, but you could lose ground quickly. And it's really important that Canadians be vigilant about not allowing corporate values to take over the shared human values for your country.
Now, you've been in Canada acting as a witness with regards to the DTC ads potentially starting up here in this country. And recently, the FDA announced that they want to distill down the list of side effects that we will hear in Canada simply because we watch American broadcasting. So I know you know a lot about this issue. What do you think about the FDA's recent announcement?
Well, I think it's a terrible idea because the side effects are very real. And all the side effects don't make it into those disclaimers. When in litigation, when we get millions of documents and can figure out what really happened in those clinical trials, you find other side effects and frequency of side effects that often hadn't been disclosed. But I think cutting down, the reason why direct-to-consumer advertising took off in the United States in the late 1990s was because the FDA cut down the amount of the amount of information about side effects at that point. And oftentimes when you're watching a drug ad from the United States, you'll see information in Shape magazine or go to Golf magazine to see the rest of the side effects. Call 800, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm sure nobody does. But that was the bargain that was made with the F, between the FDA and the drug companies in the late 90s that they would cut down on the side effect reporting and provide other sources of information. Now they're going to do it again. And in the United States, we're spending about $4.5 billion a year on direct-to-consumer advertising. That's plateaued over the last few years because I think that the drug companies are squeezing out as much money as they can from the public through this advertising. Now, if they cut down the amount of side effects, and you can see the beautiful butterflies and the sunsets and all the happiness for more a greater percentage of time in the advertisements are going to be more effective, and you're going to see the drug company spending on advertisements go up.
Dr. Abramson, I mentioned Tim Hortons coffee shops. There isn't one in the country. I don't know that there's ever been one that's closed. You can never go to one without waiting. The lineups are there, whether it's 10 o'clock on Sunday morning or 11 o'clock on Tuesday night. We are absolutely addicted to caffeine, which is going to lead to our segment in our next hour about sleep deprivation. I asked you earlier if you could rank the health issues in the United States in terms of what crises you faced. I mentioned obesity, but would you take us from the top, number one, two, and three? What are the biggest health issues in North America?
The biggest health issues are that because medical research has been turned over to commercial interests, we're not getting research, or we're getting virtually no research, on the health benefits of healthy lifestyle and non-medical treatments. So in terms of obesity, in terms of feelings of sadness, in terms of hypertension, heart attack, stroke, all those things, the effective preventive measures that people can do for themselves are getting pushed aside and minimized in doctors' minds because of the thinking that prescription drugs can take care of these problems. So I think the biggest health problem is the expropriation of control of one's health by commercial interests. It's much like the women's movement in the 1960s when they said the women were saying, don't treat us like objects. We're subjects. Stop treating us like we're just objects to be treated, to be used and thrown away. Now the market has spread to treat all of us as objects, our children, our parents, ourselves, we're all as objects. And I think that's the biggest health problem, and that's what we see in the United States. In for example, about 25, a quarter of the women between 20 and 49, I think, are taking antidepressants in the United States. It's craziness that we're drugging everybody. Mm-hmm. They're called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And all the theory when Prozac came out in the late 80s was that depression is about a serotonin deficit in the brain and we can conquer this with our drugs. Well, nobody knows if depression has anything to do with serotonin. We just know that those drugs increase serotonin levels. But we don't know what depression is.
I meet a lot of women who are on statins, Dr. Abramson.
Sorry?
I meet a lot of women who are taking statin drugs. And
absolutely. And those women who don't have heart disease, this is going to be in my new book. A chapter is going to be about this. A woman who was put on statins by her doctor. She wasn't exercising. She was overweight. She was smoking a little bit. But got put on statins because the doctor thought that she was doing the right thing for the patient to prevent heart disease, until the patient had a massive heart attack and a cardiac arrest, and just because there happened to be an ambulance in the neighborhood, her life was saved.
Doctor, I'm very sad to say that we have almost no time left. I wonder, in the next 1 minute, can you just summarize our conversation for those who have joined us in midstream? And let me get you to start it by reflecting on this question. Who has the greater grip? Putin in Russia on the Russian people with very stiff restrictions on the media, or the drug company's grip on America?
Well, that's exactly right, Andy, and that's the point, and I'm going to discuss that in the next book, because the word is propaganda. And when we look at propaganda in a communist country or a totalitarian country, we see politicians creating the impression that there's national sovereignty and there's a collective support of a government that doesn't really represent the people. But that propaganda in the liberal countries, in the marketplace-based countries like Canada and the United States, that propaganda takes a different form. It's not putting plastering a single politician's picture on the wall. It's in bombarding people with these commercial messages that redefine how they approach the quality of their lives and their family's health. And that, too, is propaganda. Mm-hmm. And what we've got to understand is that the propaganda that we, in our environment, is hard to see, like fish can't see water. We can see, if you look at North Korea, we can see the propaganda supporting the government. But now, with those same eyes, look at the drug advertisements and the influence of the drug companies on the medical journals, and that's a commercial propaganda. And that takes away our freedom just as much as political propaganda.
Fascinating. What is your book going to be coming out this year, Dr. Abramson?
No, I'm just starting on it, so it's going to be a couple of years.
Okay. Have you got a title picked out as yet?
I don't yet.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that. We'll have to have you back on.
If any of your listeners have a suggestion for a title, please.
I'll help you.
Doctor, you're talking to us from Harvard, from Boston. Why don't you sound like the Kennedys?
Well, I don't know.
I knew there'd be one question you couldn't answer. It's the only one. Dr. John Abramson, what a pleasure to have you. What an honor to have you with us. We will have to chat again and keep up the good work, my friend. It's incredibly sad what's happening to the state of our health in North America, especially given all the resources that we have compared to other parts of the world. So keep up the good fight, and if you ever do run for something, I'll vote for you.
Well, Andy and Pam, we're not going to make progress unless journalists like you are willing to bring the truth to the public, because the truth gets blocked every time the corporate interests get a chance to block it. So it's going to take journalists of courage to get this story out.
Well, we appreciate all your work. And for people who want to look up more information, Dr. Abramson's website is overdosedamerica.com.
Wow. What an hour. What an hour that was. Pam, anything you want to add?
This weekend, I'm going to be teaching my part four class of Dr. Weston A. Price's work at the Central Library. And I have more information about the class on my website, which is just my name, pamkilleen.com.
I don't know if you have to run. I want to ask you about sleep deprivation. Can you stay for a couple minutes?
I'll stay for a few minutes.
Okay,
yeah.
Terrific. Okay. Sleep deprivation, time change weekend. They say heart attacks are going to soar and so are car crashes. Is it poppycock or is it real? Sleep deprivation, a real issue in our society. Back with that in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
Yeah, we're so sleep deprived as a population that what basically happens is losing that one extra hour of sleep, and you think, what's an hour? Actually results in more workplace accidents, it actually results in more traffic accidents, and it may actually even result in more people having heart attacks.
I don't know. I don't know what to think. The doctor that Steve Garrison had on this morning says heart attacks spike after the time change weekend, which we're heading into, and car crashes spike. Gee, I was going to go out driving this weekend, but I think I'll hide in my basement. I don't know. I don't want to be really facetious. I know we have a sleep epidemic. Dr. Brock Rondeau, a sleep specialist who travels around the world and speaks on this issue, has been a guest on the show. He's right here in London, Ontario, right at Huron and Highbury. Pam Killeen has to dash out the door because she's about to play tennis. We never talk about this. You are an accomplished tennis player. Holy smokes, are you good. I can't believe the tournament you're going to, the tournament you're winning, you're going up to Western. Anyway, we don't have time to chat because you literally have the car running. Sleep deprivation, number one question. Do we have it and how serious?
It's very serious, Andy. And the statistics that I think we're reading about every day about the problem around sleep deprivation, insomnia, and so on, I think the numbers are way lower than they really are. And the reason why I suspect the numbers are much higher is simply because people have normalized sleep issues, that if they're only sleeping 6 hours a night or if they're having a lot of trouble falling asleep at night, I think that they're normalizing these symptoms and suffering in silence. So I don't think there's any real way to get the true numbers. I know that when people come to me and they're struggling with chronic fatigue, depression, fibromyalgia, brain fog, anxiety, 95% of my clients are suffering with sleep problems of some kind. 95% of them. It's rare for somebody to come to me and say that they're sleeping well. They're not getting solid sleeps. So they're waking up exhausted with cobwebs in the brain and so on. So there's not a high quality of sleep if they are sleeping as well. So this is a real serious problem. The fact that they're saying when you're sleep deprived, there's going to be more car accidents. I think we need to take a step back, because the reason why people are not getting a good night's sleep is simply because they're not healthy to begin with. That is the real key issue. My clients are not healthy. They are very sick. And one of the systems that goes wrong in the body when people have insomnia or problems falling asleep or staying asleep is that the adrenal glands are not working properly. So 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, internally, they feel as if they're running away from a lion. And so if you're running away from a lion, there's no time for sleeping, eating, or sex. So essentially, all three of those systems break down. And to get them resuscitated, to get these systems working properly again, you've got to focus on proper adrenal gland function. And that has a lot to do with nutrition.
I figured the word nutrition was going to come into it.
Mm-hmm.
So what do people do? They turn to sleeping pills.
Sleeping pills, which have side effects, terrible side effects. I mean, we've seen recently with the Kennedy woman and the side effects of taking, I think it was Ambien. There's definite side effects to taking medications like that. And I think where I talk to my clients and they're taking medications, they want to do everything they can to get off their medication because they don't like the side effects.
That drug, that story scared me badly, because not only was she so drugged that she was driving all over the road and eventually crashed, but she was so drugged that she didn't even know she was drugged.
Well, remember ABC did that piece with the journalist who took, I think it was Ambien.
Yes.
And basically the next day, she shouldn't have been driving a car is what they determined in that piece. There's some definite dangerous side effects to using sleep aids, and yet there's more that can be done other than relying on these things. So I think that one of the key messages I have in my classes and when I work with people is to stabilize the adrenal glands. One of the best fuels is going to be animal fat. Actually, in salt is very stabilizing for the adrenal glands. So my clients usually increase their intake of animal fat, increase their intake of salt, and they can sometimes notice improvements. But I mean, what I'm talking about is very complex biochemistry, and it can take many, many months in order to stabilize the adrenal glands so that people have a good night's sleep.
You got a tennis game to go to. You go.
Right.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to play you a portion of an interview with a doctor that Steve Garrison interviewed this morning, who says heart attacks literally spike around this coming weekend, the time change weekend. And then I want to talk to the police. Is it true? Is it true that car crashes spike? But Diane wants to jump in now.
Yes. Is it advisable to take melatonin? Because I was told by a friend that they take melatonin before they go to bed, and it helps them sleep, and they feel refreshed when they wake up in the morning.
There's a couple problems with taking melatonin. Number one, melatonin can throw off a female's menstrual cycle. So there are side effects to taking melatonin. The other problem with taking melatonin is that it can downregulate your body's ability to produce melatonin on its own. And the third problem I have with melatonin is that it's really not getting to the root cause of the problem. So if it's an emergency and people only take melatonin from time to time, I don't see a problem with that, but the trouble is people are using melatonin day in and day out, and that's where you're going to see some problems.
Pam, you go, and that's an order, because Pam has a tennis game, and I don't want to get in trouble with her. Okay, Diane, sleep deprivation, do you see it in the people you associate with?
Yes, I do, and in myself. I get up in the morning, Andy. I feel like I should be just going back to bed. And I even have one of those lamps that you sit under.
Okay.
My husband doesn't get any work out of me in the wintertime. Winter's worse.
Let me ask you, do you have trouble falling asleep and then waking up, or do you just can't get to sleep?
I'm so tired when I go to bed. In fact, I even fall asleep on the couch in the evening. And when I haul myself off to bed, I may fall asleep, and then maybe an hour and a half later, I wake up. And then I'm tossing and turning, and I fall asleep. And then I hear the clock in the living room dinging. It could be 3 or 4 o'clock, and then I'm awake till 5 or 6.
Oh.
And then I have the alarm set for 7, and then I'm so tired, I change it to 8. Then I turn it off, you know, because and half my day, I'm just tired. Right now, I got up at 9 o'clock this morning, and I honestly feel like I could go back to bed now.
Diane, I have to.